It seems to me remarkable that after 2,000 years of talking about Jesus, of 2,000 years of this thing we call the Christian faith, sometimes the most important things about it we just don't get. In a little while, we're going to share this mystical thing called Holy Communion, where the bread is broken, the wine is poured out, to remind us that he who was God gave everything for us. It's the central act of remembering and of being drawn together into the community of God's love. I wonder if you'll agree with me that whenever and wherever we lay this table and we speak Jesus' own words of invitation, there's hardly one of us who doesn't wonder sometimes if we're welcome. How often have I been asked as a minister by somebody, am I allowed to go to the communion? And shamedly, with all I know about Jesus, how many times haven't I asked myself the same question? Have you? Of course, the question is not just about communion. Our hesitation about this ritual is just a symbol of a much deeper struggle about what kind of people we are and what kind of God is. And that's why before we uncover the table today, I want us to think around this. I want us to struggle with matters of us and God. And I want us to pray that God's Spirit will come to our aid and we'll really get it this time and we'll be free. So I invite you to journey with me through three movements. The first two inspired by our scripture and the third by the history of Methodist Christians in the world. And I call the first movement the fight. When Jacob laid down his head on that stone pillow near the Yabok crossing, he was in for a very rough night. It would have been bad anyway, because he was a bad guy. He lived by untruth. He had bribed his elder brother out of his inheritance. He had then disguised himself as his elder brother in order to swindle him out of everything, the blessing as well, to swindle a blind father. Now, two decades later, his comeuppance was at hand. Esau, with 400 armed men, was on his way. Jacob had sent his slaves, his flocks, and even his wives in front of him as a kind of offering, while he would cower behind them. He was terrified, and so he had readied these bribes to try and stop Esau from killing him, always ready to save his own skin. But that was nothing to what he was going to get that night. He was going to have a much more terrifying adversary. We read that a man wrestled him until the break of day, and later on he was convinced that he had been up against God. Now, I don't know about you and wrestling matches. I don't like watching them. Once they grab each other and get into a knot, I never know whose arms are whose and whose legs are wrapped around who. And this story is a little bit like that. as these two contend, things get tangled up. Each desperate to get a grip on each other, and two issues intertwine with each other. They seem to be at play, both of these issues, and both seem to be about identity. As dawn breaks, the upshot seems to be that as these two adversaries confront each other, exhausted, Jacob with a dislocated hip, because the stranger had clubbed him once, a really good one, and the stranger still unable to break Jacob's grip on him. But as the day breaks, something has shifted. Jacob is no longer Jacob, the slime ball. He has a new name, a new identity. He's going to be called Israel. His behavior is going to change. And something else has shifted. The stranger is no longer anonymous, but has a name that Jacob hardly dares to pronounce. He realized that he has been wrestling with God. And amazingly, his life has been spared. And the next day, instead of cowering behind the slaves and the flocks and the wives, when he sees Esau advancing with 400 armed men, Jacob goes out ahead of them. He goes to meet the brother he betrayed. And he bows low in repentance, expecting the worst, and for once being willing to face it. Then comes the surprise, the God surprise. God is full of surprises. Esau ran to meet him and embraced him. He threw his arms around him and he kissed him. And they wept. Remind you of a story Jesus told once, maybe? So I wonder, as we thrash about wrestling with God in our own way and trying to prove ourselves worthy of him, if we stopped and listened, we might hear the words, "There's no need to wrestle any longer. I've been longing to give you something. I've been longing to give you a new name, a new life, a mended life." And remember, I wasn't just present in the wrestling. I was also there in the running towards you and the tears of joy. Jesus did tell a story that ended up like that, and it was told for us. That's the first movement. Now, the second I call the feast. It's so important to know that we're welcomed by God. Too many of us think that exclusion is the way to find security and a better life. We join clubs and we feel important because the first words we see when we go through the door are "members only." We believe that if we can only remove certain people from our midst and our society by screaming, "Abba Hambe, Abba Hambe," life will miraculously improve for the rest of us. Churches are not immune from this disease. Churches can also become members-only clubs with their own way of saying, "Abba Hambe, away with you." I look out here and I see some faces of people who were there when I began my ministry at our beloved Bateconst Street Methodist Church 59 years ago. Maybe some of you with long teeth and longer memories were present at my first leaders' meeting. Let me remind you, because I was brand new, the stewards had prepared the agenda the way it always apparently was done. And I remember my puzzlement when we got to an item of the agenda, which I wasn't sure what I was reading. The item was called simply one word, stuff. And I asked for an explanation and was told that, well, that was when punishment was decided upon and meted out to delinquent members, usually young girls who had fallen pregnant. When I got over my deep shock, I indicated that I was striking that item off the agenda and never wanted to see it there again, ever, ever, ever. But sadly, we still seem to find ways of saying Abba Humbi to some people, people who need broken people, who need to be healed rather than hunted. And sometimes we do just that. Jesus never gave birth to a members only or even a saints only club. Our gospel reading shows that Jesus, well, he was looking for solitude because he had just heard the dreadful news about the execution of his cousin, John the Baptist. But there was no rest for him. The crowds find him, and his compassion goes out to them and draws him back into the work of healing. It's getting late. His disciples see the problem ahead. These people have got to be sent away now if they're going to get to the villages and get food. But absurdly, ridiculously, Jesus says, no need, no need. You feed them. The disciples comb the crowd and find nothing. Nothing except one of them reports with some embarrassment that he's come across a little boy with just five little loaves and a couple of fishes. And some people snigger. But Jesus doesn't laugh. He says, bring them, bring them. Now, I love the picture in my mind of this kid threading his way through the crush, hand in hand with a big, burly disciple. You know, like one of those kids who runs out onto the rugby field with his hand in Sears' hand or Eben's hand. He stares at Jesus as the carpenter of Nazareth takes his little offering. And Jesus looks up to heaven and he says the blessing. And then he breaks the bread. Does it sound familiar? And tells the disciples to distribute the food to 5,000 men, we read, as well as all the women and children. Maybe that was the first communion. Who knows? But do you get it? Nobody asked, are you a member? Have you been baptized? Have you been to confirmation? Or are you old enough to understand what's going on? No. The only question that hung in the air was, are you hungry? Please get it. And so we come to the third movement. Freedom. and friend of all. Let's move about 1,740 years on from the time of Jesus. Here are two brothers, one a philosophy don at Oxford University and the other inclined to poetry and also linked with the university and studying classics. And both of them are priests in the Church of England. Their names are John and Charles Wesley. And because of what God does in their lives, their nation will never be the same. The longest and most profound revival of faith sweeps across the land. But oh my goodness, how these two have wrestled. They wrestled with God. Are they hungry for God? We can't go into the details this morning, but throughout their years at Oxford, unlike Jacob, they have both lived lives of earnest prayer, disciplined study of the scriptures, stern morality, and regular works of mercy amongst the prisoners and the poor. Their daily disciplines are lived out so rigidly that they are mocked at the university, and they are nicknamed Methodists, far too methodical for us. And the truth is that they are better than good. They are saintly. But nothing they do brings an end to the gnawing hunger in their souls. Nothing brings them peace. Their souls are in agony. Until in 1738, with both of them in their mid-30s and pretty despairing about whether they would ever find the real thing. Within a week of each other, first Charles, then John, learned through deep encounters with the all-embracing, forgiving, transforming love of God that their wrestling could cease. Something, a new flame, exploded within them. And they suddenly became sure that the heart of God was not judgment, but something else, love. Love that could not be earned. God's love was a free gift, free and undeserved. Something that John, the preacher, was later to call free grace, free grace, free grace. And something that his brother Charles was to write about again and again and again. In the literally thousands of hymns he wrote. John couldn't stop talking about it. Charles couldn't stop singing about it. And suddenly, a small three-letter word became the central word of that amazing spiritual renewal. And I pray to God that it could be the central word always of those of us who claim to follow in that tradition and everybody else who shares in our life here. That three little word, you've guessed it, was all. All. No exceptions. God's love, God's gift of newness, God's gift of a new identity is for all. All means all. And a little later they realized how closely their experience of struggle aligned with that ancient story of Jacob at the ford of Yabbok, a place he then christened Peniel. So it came that Charles Wesley wrote, and we are about to sing, one of the great celebrations of their new freedom, their release, and of the allness of God's love. We're going to sing some of the verses of that hymn, which is they called Wrestling Jacob. Don't let the oldness of the language put you off, because I know that whenever I read the words of Wrestling Jacob, written by the poet Charles Wesley, whenever I read it, I know it's my story too, and maybe yours. The last two words of this hymn say it all. To me and to all your mercies move, your nature and your name is love. Thank you, Lauren.